The subcommittee on childcare access and affordability will come together. There is a quorum present. Representative Kreisha, do I have a motion to approve the minutes from?
I move the minutes, Madam Chair.
Hearing, okay, so Representative Kreisha moves approval of the minutes from February 1st. Any additions, corrections, or changes? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes from February 1st are approved. Members, today we're going to be hearing some bills. The bills will not be referred through the floor as they are in the jurisdiction of HHS reform. But a memo with the committee report will be sent to the Chair Schumacher memorializing the subcommittee's actions today. I'd like to note that in order to meet subcommittee deadline, DFL Lee Flanagan and I have agreed to hear bills in draft format that is in the form of House File XXXX, as long as you have the language in front of us. If you have a bill that hasn't been jacketed or dropped, please do that ASAP. The bill we have in consideration is House File 139. Welcome to the chair, or welcome to the committee. Chair Nowlock.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I had talked with you about the fact that we'll need some kind of an amendment regarding the effective date on this. Is that something that we act on in this committee, or how do we handle that?
Well, first I'm going to move that your bill be approved and recommended to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform, and then you can just go ahead and state your oral amendment.
Okay, I'd like the oral amendment to say this section is effective July 1st, 2018. Okay. And the reason for that is I'm understanding from minute the software people that it will take some time for them to do the software changes in order to implement the bill.
Okay. I will move adoption of Representative Knobloch's oral amendment. Any discussion to the amendment this morning? All those in favor say aye.
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 All right. Those opposed say no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We have the bill before us. Representative Knobloch to the bill as amended.
Well, Madam Chair, members, House File 139 is a bill that deals with a very local situation. It allows licensed daycare centers that are located in a city that is in more than one county to have their subsidized daycare reimbursed at the rate offered by the highest county. The city of St. Cloud is in three counties, Stearns County, Benton County, and Sherburne County. I have a constituent who owns a building in Benton County which has housed a daycare facility. The original tenant of the facility had previously operated their daycare facility in Stearns County. When they opened the facility in Benton County, they found the Benton County rate was significantly lower than either the Stearns or Sherburne County rate, even though their daycare was just a few hundred feet from the Sherburne County line. For example, today the Benton County hourly rate is 35% to 62% below the Stearns County rate for some categories of reimbursement. This is because daycare rates are based on a formula based on looking at other rates within the county, and because the very few daycares Benton County has are mainly located far to the east of St. Cloud, where the costs are less and the sample size is so low, they don't really reflect the St. Cloud city market. I don't have a fiscal note on the bill, but I know that it had a very modest cost when we brought it up last year. I believe it was $58,000 for the first year and something in the range of several hundred thousand dollars per year after that. I don't think we should be penalizing one side of town versus another when effectively everyone within the city of St. Cloud is in the same market, and so I would urge your support for this bill.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify? All right. Representative Knobloch, is there any further discussion of your bill?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Hearing none, I renew my motion that House File 139 as amended be approved and recommended to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. The motion prevails and a subcommittee report on House File 139 with the adopted amendment will be prepared for the full committee. Thank you, Chair Knobloch, for your time this morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Next up, Vice Chair Peterson, with a bill that we are considering And that is House File 723. And Representative Peterson moves the bill be approved and recommended to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. We have the bill before us. Representative Peterson, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill relates to two issues, and they're involved with the Minnesota Child Care Assistance Program, also known as CCAP. First, it addresses access, and the other, it addresses affordability, which I think is pretty important to this committee. One of the things that it will do is update the market rates that providers are paid. Right now, they're working on six-year-old rates, and it's simply not keeping up. And also, by adjusting the sliding fee scale, it will comply with the federal block grant rules. So I do have a few testifiers here today that can address the bill in a much more in-depth way. And I guess we'll start out with Claire Sanford, if you'd like to introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Peterson. My name is Claire Sanford, and I represent the Minnesota Child Care Association. MCCA is a member of the Kids Can't Wait Coalition, on whose behalf I'm here today. And Kids Can't Wait is a diverse coalition of organizations concerned with the well-being of low-income Minnesota families, specifically focusing on access to child care. And as Representative Peterson talked about, we're focusing today, obviously, on child care assistance and specifically the basic sliding fee program. We know that child care access is a critical two-generation approach to family stability, economic development, and poverty alleviation in Minnesota. Children are able to access safe and stable care during a critical period in development, and parents are able to access education and employment, furthering their families' economic prospects. The subcommittee has already heard plenty of testimony about the federal reforms to child care assistance that Representative Peterson just mentioned, and with which Minnesota is still substantially out of compliance. The reforms are very clear on the need to make sure that provider reimbursement rates keep up with the cost of providing child care services. When they don't, low-income families are effectively shut out of child care choices. Minnesota, Greater Minnesota, has roughly 2,000 fewer spaces enrolled with children in basic sliding fee child care assistance than it did in the early 2000s when rates were at the 75th percentile of market rates. Family supports have decreased while provider shortage has increased. Federal reforms state the reimbursement rates must be updated regularly, no more than every few years, using the most recent market rate survey available. Minnesota is currently at the 25th percentile of 2011 market rates. The governor's budget proposal this year increases reimbursement rates by going to the keeping the 25th percentile, but going to the 2016 market rate survey. However, those rates would not take effect until February 2018, a full year from now. And by then, the 2016 market survey will be 2 years out of date. This bill offers a better way. It would increase rates to the 25th percentile of 2016 rates beginning this July and would allow for automatic adjustments when Minnesota conducts its market rate survey every 2 years. Providers need certainty that rates will follow the market cost of care in order to continue to operate and or expand, and supporting CCAP rates is supporting a workforce of overwhelmingly female professionals and many people of color. Parents need to know that over time their child care purchasing power will remain somewhat competitive so they're able to enroll where they choose for their child and maintain that enrollment. And the state needs to know that rates will adjust to follow the market for responsible investment. The automatic adjustment mechanism ensures that Minnesota stays in compliance with this federal requirement over time. Without the automatic adjustment to every market rate survey, the legislature will have to act affirmatively on this issue every 2 years. We'll keep doing this every 2 years, and it would be easy to slip out of compliance. This bill also includes an appropriation to provide relief to some of CCAP's over 5,000 waiting families and to get them on the path to school and employment success. Without some additional funding, inflation will cause those wait lists to grow and the number of families to shrink further over time. We thank those of you who have signed on in support of this measure and urge the legislature to adopt both an increased reimbursement rate with automatic adjustments and an additional appropriation to provide CCAP access to waiting families because kids can't wait. Thank you.
Please state your name for the record.
Sure. My name is Amanda Lederman. I am a program director at a child care center in Coon Rapids, and I am a member of the Minnesota Child Care Association. So I would like to speak about the child care reimbursement rates. And I have a personal story. The center that I manage, just about 4 years ago when I began there, was on the verge of closing. The families that I serve are majority low-income, most of them use child care assistance, and the difference was just too great for us to kind of manage the financials of the building. Luckily, right around that time, scholarships were implemented, and I was able to get a very good percentage of my families on the pathway scholarships, which helped supplement the difference of child care costs that we were not receiving. And over the course of time, we've been able to not only stay in business but thrive because we've also partnered with Early Head Start, which has given us some additional financial support. And because of that, we've been able to kind of stay open. But I know that there are some programs that are not able to access those additional resources, and they are really struggling. I know that there are some of my own director friends within the community that are kind of in that position. And so I just want to speak to kind of pressing for additional reimbursement rates. And that is it.
So. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning and welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Stephanie Thomas, and I work with the YMCA of the Greater Twin Cities. The YMCA operates 13 early childhood centers across the Twin Cities, and currently all of those centers are NAACP accredited and Parent Aware 4-star rated or in that process. The rates that we charge are considered middle road rates, and the CCAP funds right now do not currently cover our full rate at any of our centers. That gap of rate is impactful to both our organization and to the families that we serve. And I believe if we are not able to fully cover rates for child care centers, it will limit high quality access for families across Minnesota. So I urge you to consider the bill. Thank you.
All right. Are there any questions from members on the committee? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify this morning on this bill? Okay. Representative Peterson, is there any further discussion on your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a great bill. We're ready to go on to the next step and move this forward and help a lot of Minnesota hardworking families.
I want to thank you for carrying this important piece of legislation. So hearing no discussion, Representative Peterson renews her motion that House File 723 be approved and recommended to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. I guess we have to take a vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, now seeing none. The motion prevails, and the subcommittee report on House File 723 is prepared for the full committee. So, all right.
So the bill we have up for consideration is an unnumbered bill, also known as XXXX, but authored by Representative or Chair Franzen. And I understand the jackets are getting signatures, and the bill will be introduced in the near future. And so, Representative Franzen, do you move that the bill be approved and recommended to the Committee on HHS Reform?
Right. Good morning, everyone. So House File Quad X is a bill to exempt both family and center-based child care providers from the positive supports rule, which went into effect August 2015. The rule stems from the Jensen Settlement Agreement, which settled a lawsuit alleging that adult residents of a state-run treatment center were subject to illegal and unconstitutional seclusion and restraint. The agreement refers only to this treatment center, to additional adult foster care programs at other state-operated locations serving those with developmental disabilities and severe behavioral problems. In an attempt to change the culture of those serving persons with developmental disabilities, DHS administratively applied the provisions of this rule to all DHS licensed programs, which includes licensed child care providers. Licensed child care providers are private businesses, not state-operated locations. Being operated by the state and being licensed by the state are two different things. I'm concerned about this rule, along with other child care providers, that this rule is being applied to child care programs based on its genesis, training required, and additional administrative burden put on these private programs. And Ms. Sanford is going to provide in a bit a brief overview. Over the fall, I co-chaired the Task Force on Access to Affordable Child Care with Senator Wicklund. We heard a lot of testimony from child care providers about this rule. The task force included looking into the applicability of the rule for child care settings as one of its regulatory recommendations. There is real concern that the rule places an undue burden on providers, especially given the very small number of children with disabilities covered by the rule served in typical child care settings. Due to this burden, there is also a concern of that enforcement of the rule will cause many child care programs to restrict access to families of children with developmental disabilities. Children who we want to be in inclusive settings and families for whom options are already limited. In short, I fear the very real possibility that this rule could actually decrease access to child care, which is, of course, the opposite of what the subcommittee is charged with doing. Child care providers are required to access mandatory positive supports training before serving any child who meets the criteria to be covered by the rule. This training is 8 to 14 hours of specific instruction on issues that mostly do not pertain to the work of child care. Appropriate and inappropriate uses of shackles, psychotropic medications, solitary confinement, etc. This training is on top of the training that providers are mandated to do in order to provide care. So Ms. Sanford is here to share more about the concerns of child care providers, and I do believe that there's some testimony in your packet.
Ms. Sanford.
Thank you, Chair Franson. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is still Claire Sanford, long time no see. And for the time being, I am still the Government Relations Chair for the Minnesota Child Care Association, but we'll see about that after today. The Minnesota Child Care Association represents about 250 child care centers across the state, from single programs to large multi-site organizations. And I just want to direct your attention to a couple handouts that I'll be referring to that are in your packets. One has the Minnesota DHS logo on the top and is called Licensed Child Care Providers and the Positive Supports Rule. And the other one is a letter written by General Counsel at New Horizon Academy, and I'll be referring to both of those. Thank you, Chair Franson, for sponsoring this bill and for that wonderful introduction. Child care providers have been concerned about the interaction of the Positive Supports Rule and the work we do since first learning about it in the summer of 2015. As Rep. Franson stated, the rule stems from the Jensen settlement, which settled a lawsuit where it was alleged that vulnerable adults in a state-run treatment center were subject to illegal and unconstitutional seclusion and restraint. Serious things, as Rep. Franson just said. Handcuffs, leg shackles, serious stuff. The agreement's scope refers only to that treatment center, two additional adult foster care programs, and other state-operated locations serving those with developmental disabilities and severe behavioral problems. In an attempt to change the culture of those serving persons with disabilities, which is not a bad thing, provisions of the agreement were applied to all DHS licensed programs, which of course includes licensed child care providers. And I'd like to be clear from the outset, Minnesota Child Care Association, MCCA, does not disagree with the intent of the Positive Supports Rule. There should be protections for individuals with developmental disabilities, and the alleged abuse of vulnerable adults that precipitated the lawsuit needed to come to light, be stopped, and future experiences like that prevented through changes in oversight. So we do not disagree with the intent of this rule. Compliance with the rule, however, which seems to have been intended for a very specific population of adults with developmental disabilities in state-run programs, places a tremendous burden on typical child care providers. Not specialized therapeutic programs that are specially staffed to deal with children with very high needs, but your typical family child care provider in your town or the child care center down the street. The rule lays out a confusing definition of which children could meet the definition of developmental disability or related condition to which the rule pertains. And if you look at the licensed child care provider's handout, if you look at page 2, there's the heading, does the PSR, the positive supports rule, apply to a child in my care? And it goes through information and onto the next page to try to help child care providers figure out if they are serving or could serve a child that meets this very specific developmental disability definition. DHS has done a wonderful job of ameliorating a lot of child care provider confusion in the field by explaining that only a very specific population of children meet this developmental disability or related condition diagnosis that triggers provider compliance with the positive supports rule. DHS has also pointed out, same handout, second paragraph on the first page, that the rule is likely to affect child care providers differently than other licensed settings to which it is applied. By the nature of the ages of children served in child care, starting from birth on up, and the rapid developmental changes occurring in the first years of life, many children who meet this rule diagnosis may not have the diagnosis upon enrollment in our programs. Also, issues may surface and build upon each other, and those children may be diagnosed later when they are enrolled in our programs. Due to this reality, DHS advises in this handout that more frequent review of whether or not the rule applies to specific children is warranted in child care than it would be in other settings where the rule is applied. So besides some confusion and anxiety, because this is not black and white by any means for any of us, to know exactly who the rule applies to and how often providers need to review it, there are additional burdens that child care providers are very concerned about. Training is the biggest concern in terms of quantity, cost, and its application to our field. Child care providers, as Rep. Franson stated, are required to access all mandatory positive supports rule training before serving any child who meets the criteria covered by the rule. This training is 8 to 14 hours of specific instruction with significant content unrelated to what we do with very young children, as Rep. Franson stated. Shackles, handcuffs, use of medications to restrain people and control behavior, etc. Much of this is already explicitly prohibited in child care regulations. Training is required of all staff who provide direct services to a child with a developmental disability or related condition, and also for those who have responsibility for developing, implementing, monitoring, or supervising positive support strategies. So it's our understanding that basically every staff member who comes into contact with a child who meets this definition or who supervises plans and implements things for that child must complete the training. The core training is 8 hours in the first year. An additional 4 hours are required for certain staff and an additional 2 hours for others. We're looking at requiring up to 14 hours of training on things that rarely apply to the type of setting and age group we work with and to very, very few children served in our settings. I'll refer you to the second handout now. Thank you for bearing with me on this, which is the letter with the New Horizon Academy logo at the top. This is a letter from General Counsel at New Horizon Academy, which is a large Minnesota-based child care provider. It lays out the training requirements for child care providers as well as associated costs. In it, in the letter, the estimated cost to train all staff at that organization to comply with the rule is estimated at $538,000 in the first year. This burden is especially significant given the tiny percentage of children with these specific disabilities covered by the rule that New Horizon Academy or other providers may currently serve or serve in the future. In addition to training, there are increased documentation and administration requirements. Compliance with the rule includes additional items mentioned in your DHS handout, such as the creation of a positive supports transition plan, the completion of a functional behavioral assessment for the affected child, an emergency use of manual restraint policy, the use of a behavioral intervention report form, and a 3-page positive supports evaluation that must be completed every 6 months in conjunction with parents for each affected child. We've already heard from many of our members that the costs, both financial and time, represent an unreasonable accommodation in order to serve children affected by the rule. Many have also said they would need to severely restrict or refuse to serve children who present with a diagnosis covered by the rule or who obtain such a diagnosis while enrolled in the program. And I'm not talking about flat-out discrimination against children with disabilities, which is, of course, illegal, and none of us want to do. I'm talking about the inability of child care providers to meet these specific requirements in the context of the staffing, ratio, training, and other things already in place under licensing. The Minnesota Disability Law Center has helpful resources for families with children of disabilities searching for child care, which also lays that out for families, that their child may be refused services by some providers if they cannot kind of operationally or financially meet the cost of accommodating their child. Obviously, we want all children of all abilities to be in the least restrictive community settings possible. Our members have families and stories of children with significant disabilities they've been able to successfully serve now or in the past, but whom under this rule they feel they could not meet the new requirements to serve. Restricting child care access is one issue, delaying access is another. Because providers must have all of this training before serving a child who qualifies under the rule, a family could present to a provider, say that their child has this diagnosis, and the provider might not have any of the training yet because they didn't serve a child with the diagnosis before, so they didn't need to get it. But now they would need to get it, and they might have to tell that family, well, you need to wait several months to enroll because we need to get this training. And when you're looking for child care, you often don't have several months to wait. So, in closing, I do want to say that MCCA and its members have worked with DHS since the rule was announced to address these concerns, and DHS staff have been very willing partners in trying to figure this out together, and they continue to be. But our members are very concerned that they can't be in limbo forever and are worried about starting to get licensing citations if these unattainable requirements are not met. The real losers will be children and families turned away from the very supports and services they seek. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stanford. Are there any questions from the members? Representative Krishak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, thank you for your comments. So I'm sorry, I didn't have enough coffee, so you lost me like 20 minutes into your speech.
I probably lost myself.
Walk me through the second and third term of FEPS. And on the ground, what's actually happening with this?
Chair Quam, Representative.
Ms. Sanford.
What's actually happening with this right now for child care providers is that technically the rule has been in effect since August 2015, but there was a lot of confusion on how to implement this and how child care providers were going to meet the rule. And child care providers have not, even though the rule has technically been in effect, to the best of my knowledge, child care providers have not yet received licensing citations for not complying with these requirements because DHS has been trying to develop resources and get access to additional training and things like that to address some of these concerns. But the rule's been in effect for almost 18 months, and soon, we have heard, licensors will have to start enforcing this and issuing citations, and members, providers are very concerned that they don't have what they need to be in compliance. And they don't want to risk getting a citation for not being in compliance with something they feel they just can't meet. And that is causing providers to say, you know what, it might just be easier for me to tell any child or any family of a child with one of these disabilities that we can't serve them any longer.
Representative Krishak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. Okay, so that's helpful. So it sounds like what we have is some well-intentioned, and I would imagine the child care providers want to comply, but they're worried that this is going to come hard and fast, and they're gonna, something's going to happen to them that they didn't expect. In your conversations with DHS, is there an openness to say, rather than coming right out of the chute with a citation, how about you just come with, here's a best practices checklist. Here's what we found, and we're going to help you through this, rather than, it sounds like they're afraid. I mean, it's almost like you're getting a speeding ticket. Here it is, and no real prep period on how you could have done better. Is that some of the fear that's out there?
Ms. Stanford.
Chair Quam, Representative Krishak. Partially, it's not so much the fear that this is going to come hard and fast because it has technically been in effect since August 2015 and providers have known about it, and we've had DHS out to several conferences to discuss this with our members and educate child care providers as much as possible. And as I said, DHS has not enforced this with citations yet. Licensors have been educating providers about how to comply with this rule. But we have also been told there's just a lot of uncertainty because we've been told at some point in the very near future, licensors will have to start issuing citations because we've had this period of sort of ramp up and we need to start enforcing this. And most child care providers are nowhere near right now being able to comply with these requirements.
Representative Krishak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifier. One last question. and it's very helpful. Is there a good enough relationship in all of our counties between licensors and daycare providers to have the trust that this is going to be an okay transition?
Ms. Sanford.
In your opinion, I know it's an opinion question.
Chair Quorum, Representative Cresha, I want to preface my statement by saying I represent the Minnesota Child Care Association, which represents child care centers, mm-hmm. and we are licensed by the state, whereas family child care providers are licensed by the county. So our members do not personally have those relationships mm-hmm. with county licensors, but I would refer you to, and obviously you've been there for the task force and other things, to past testimony from family child care providers and county licensors about that relationship and how they might feel about it.
Thank you.
Any further? Okay. Any other members have questions for the testifier? Okay. Would Carrie Schmitz, our next testifier, and if you can state your name and your affiliation for the record?
Sure.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you. My name is Carrie Schmitz, and I'm the director of a nationally accredited four-star parent-aware-rated child care center in Maplewood. I'd like to support this bill to exempt child care providers from the positive supports rule and talk about a special program in my center. My center is right across the street from the 3M campus. 3 years ago, my center partnered with School District 622, the North St. Paul Maplewood Oakdale School District. The school district places early childhood special education students in our program to offer them their least restrictive environment to learn alongside their typically developing peers. The first year of our partnership, 6 children were placed in my center. Each of the last 2 years, we've had the pleasure of serving 9 of the district's early childhood special ed program, which equates to 15% of our licensed preschool capacity. The district sends special education personnel such as occupational therapists, speech and language pathologists, and special education teachers to our program a few times each week to provide services and support for these children. Outside those 30 minutes of contact time with these specialists, the children are cared for, educated, and supported by my staff. Prior to each of these children's enrollment in my center, an individual education plan or an IEP meeting is conducted, and I host these at my center. In attendance are all the applicable parties, such as parents, special education teachers, speech and language therapists, occupational therapists, physical therapists, the early child psychologist, the social worker, and several teachers who completed the child's intake assessment and evaluation. On occasion, there are also members of a previous team if the child received services in the realm of birth to 3 prior to entering the 3 to 5 division of special education. At a minimum, these meetings take an hour for each child. This is in addition to the work done to complete the individual child care plan that's required when serving children with special needs so that parents, staff, and specialists are all on the same page. These children with special needs thrive in the inclusive program that my center provides. Simultaneously, the other children in the classroom learn about individual differences, acceptance, and benefit from improved teaching methods. The district compensates my center for these spaces, the children utilizing the preschool program, and the additional staff time and resources that are often needed to make this inclusion work. However, the district, the parents, my staff, and I all value the partnership and serving of these children. I'm aware that most, if not all, of the children currently served in this partnership do not meet the DHS definition of a specific and severe developmental disability that's referred to in the positive supports rule. For most, their primary needs consist of mild speech or developmental delay. Yet, as I stated previously, even these slight needs still require significant resources. Child care providers are already required to take additional steps to appropriately serve children with special needs. I have no idea how I would get my staff to attend all the additional training required by the positive supports rule, especially when so few children served in programs like ours actually meet the very specific diagnosis required. The day may come when one of these children the district assigns to my center may have such a developmental disability. Including child care centers in the positive supports rule is a burden most won't be able to take on. I don't disagree with the spirit of the rule, but I honestly don't know how my staff can meet it. It'll be a sad day when I have to turn that child away, even though the school district, the parents, and I agree our program would be a wonderful learning environment. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schmitz. Any Representative Flanagan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you talk a little bit about the IEP meeting? Is that occurring specifically because the district is involved? That wouldn't happen otherwise. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And with the, can you talk a little bit about, Mr. Chair, can you talk a little bit about the individualized individual child care plan and the requirements around that when serving children with disabilities?
Ms. Schmitz.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. An individual child care plan just is a document that we create in partnership with the parents and the teachers and the school district personnel to make sure that what's laid out in the IEP meeting or what the needs of those children are, how are we going to meet those in our center? Do we have to do anything special to accommodate for that child?
Ms. Flanagan, Representative
Flanagan. Mr. Chair, thank you. Is that something that you use for all kids or just kids with disabilities?
There are sometimes we use it for typically developing children as well.
Okay. Thank you. Any more questions?
Representative Flanagan. The IEP, I was on the school board, not as long as one of our peers was on the school board, but IEPs are a very useful tool if all parties participate, and it's great outcomes. If it's just paperwork, then, unfortunately, there aren't the improvements. And I'm glad to see coordination between all the people that are involved in a child's life, with this special tool. And Representative Krisha, did you have a question?
I do.
Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure, Ms. Schmitz, if you're the best one or if Ms. Sanford, but do you know how this came to be? Was it through legislative action? It comes through the rulemaking process? Do you know how we got to this point?
The partnership, you mean?
No, I'm sorry. This rule.
I don't know, Claire.
Yes, when you come back, Ms. Sanford, if you can again state your name and answer the crucial question.
Thank you, Chair Klum. Representative Claire Sanford, Minnesota Child Care Association. It's my understanding the positive supports rule came out of the settlement I referred to, the Jensen settlement, which was a lawsuit brought by families of adults in state-run treatment centers who were mistreated. And the positive supports rule is part of what came out of that settlement in order to ensure that things that happened to those adults don't happen in state-run facilities to other vulnerable adults. And that in an attempt to change the culture of anyone serving a person with a disability in any setting, it was administratively applied to all DHS licensed programs, not just state-run or operated programs.
Representative Krisha?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that's interesting. So, and I don't have enough background. So there was a lawsuit that involved adults, and this was then extrapolated down to licensed facilities of child care providers all the way down into your centers, but as well as individual providers. Is that correct?
Ms. Sanford.
Chair Klum, Representative Krisha, when you say individual providers, do you mean family child care providers?
Yes.
Yes, because they're also licensed through DHS settings. So any setting that is licensed by DHS, this rule applies to any children or adults that meet the specific diagnosis covered by the rule.
Representative Krisha.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so now the coffee's kicked in, I'm starting to think. So we have a situation where a lawsuit that was applied to adults at these large care facilities, which understand the intention, probably was the right thing to do, and then this is applied all the way down to a family child care provider who may have a really good relationship with somebody that has a disabled child, and these rules are going to supersede that relationship with that family child care provider in there and the family they're doing daycare for. Is that, am I interpreting that correct?
Ms. Stafford.
Chair Klum, Representative, that is my understanding.
Representative Krisha?
Well, that's just interesting.
I think so. Also, Representative Krisha, having been involved with my own children, but in the school system and with some exposure on the public safety to what happens in state-run facilities, there are differences between children and adults, and I think it'd be appropriate that there would be some difference in the rulemaking. And my understanding is that this rulemaking is sufficient to kick in a bill that I think you were around when it became law that basically says that if rulemaking causes above a certain level of expense to small employers, that it would need approval by the legislature. And I don't believe that this type of approval was part of our last session. I'm not sure if that's something that could be clarified by staff.
I'll take a look, Mr. Chair.
And thank you. And, back with you. And I didn't want to mangle your name.
It's Sarah Sunderman.
Sunderman.
That's research.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Khrushchev.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just wondering, and it sounds like you've had a relationship with DHS, and I've worked with them as well, you know, and I think they're probably trying to get to the right solution. Do you think there's a way that we cannot be so overbearing? Do you think is there a solution here? Is there a compromise that could happen to help mitigate this uncertainty?
Ms. Zaffer.
Chair Quam, Representative Khrushchev, I think there probably is. We, MCCA, brought forth an exemption bill last year, which was a temporary exemption, in which we asked for a one-year exemption from the training requirements in the rule in order to use that time to work with DHS to try to find a solution that didn't require upending the entire court settlement and all of that stuff. And our main concerns, obviously, are the costs associated with the training required and the amount of training required. And we have, our members have worked with DHS over the last year to look at what's already required in licensing for child care. Does any of that training meet the definitions of the positive support rule? Is there a way to kind of crosswalk them so that we're not adding 8 to 14 hours of additional training to child care providers, but trying to get some of it into what's already required in licensing? And again, DHS has been wonderful to work with, and we have been working together, but it's a year later, and there's still uncertainty, and our members are still not feeling comfortable with how far along that process has gotten, which is why we brought, again, this bill for an exemption.
Thank you, Representative Khrushchev.
And thank you, and I'm sorry for the line of questioning, but one last question, and then I'll go back to my box. There wasn't a whole lot of abuse going on. I mean, before this rulemaking, it's not like there was an epidemic of abuse going out there. I mean, there maybe needed to be some direction or certainly some conversations, but it sounds like to me this is almost getting us to the point where through the rulemaking process we've created this perceived situation of all this abuse by disabled kids. And that wasn't the case, was it?
Ms. Zapper.
Chair Quam, Representative Khrushchev, not that I know of. The genesis of this was a settlement involving specific adults in a specific treatment center who were allegedly mistreated. I am not a legal expert by
any means. Let's just play it today.
Okay. I'm married to one, so I can kind of pretend. I have to listen to him, so.
I know we're horrible as husbands,
but
Ms. Stafford.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Rep. Khrushchev. Of course, now I've completely lost my train of thought. Oh, epidemic of abuse. No, it was a specific court case brought on behalf of adults, the parents of adults who were abused in certain situations. And then like I said, not a legal expert, but I'll try to play one. And then through interaction with the federal Supreme Court Olmstead decision that involves people with disabilities, access to least restrictive community settings and things like that, there was a confluence of events that ended up with this settlement being the stipulations of the settlement being applied to all DHS licensed programs. But the genesis was not issues with children with specific disabilities being mistreated or inappropriately treated in child care programs.
Representative Khrushchev.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Any other questions for this? Representative Flanagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm actually wondering if DHS is here and willing to answer a couple questions.
Well, first, since we've got Ms. Stafford here, are there any further questions for her? And then we're at the point of where we're going to see if anyone from the audience, but you've been summoned. Come on down. And again, please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Mr. Chair, I'm Alex Bartolik. I'm the Director for Disability Services at the Department of Human Services. And based on your questions, my colleague, Reggie Wagner, who is with the Licensing Division, is also here.
Wonderful. Thank you. And Representative Flanagan, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bartolik and maybe Ms. Wagner as well. My question is just thinking about some of the dialogue that we've had here. Do you see alternatives to being able to serve children with disabilities? When we look at these regulations, it's quite a bit. We also, clearly all of us have the interest in making sure that we can serve all children. But if we come back to this process, I mean, is there a point where you can see different requirements or something that makes more sense for providers who are serving young children?
And I've seen Ms. Wagner approaching. if you do respond to this, please give your name and affiliation. Please go ahead.
And Mr. Chair, representatives, we've been working really hard with the Child Care Association because we all want to make sure children are served well. We know that the training that is listed in the rule is not intended to be an add-on. We know there's already training that child care providers are going through. So we did do a contract with the Center for Inclusive Child Care to be able to take all of the training that is already done and look at what meets the intent in the rule and are there some areas that aren't covered that we want to include in it. So certainly we want to look at how we can do training. There are many things that child care providers would never do, and that's true. And some of these would never trigger than some of the other components of the rule. So we want to be clear on that, and working with the child care providers has been helpful. We even clarifying, for example, that when you pick up a small child who's having a temper tantrum, that's not a restraint. You can do something quickly, or what's a therapeutic timeout that doesn't qualify under there. So we know that there's a lot of confusion, and we want to be able to offer as much clarity as possible as we go through this. The genesis for it, maybe to talk about what do we have room to do and what's leading us into this place is with the Jensen settlement, part of the court oversight was to work on three aspects. How do we improve and change services with state services? How do we do an Olmstead plan to talk about Minnesota's approach to improve services for all people with disabilities, and that's all ages and across all departments, and then also to develop a positive support rule. And the positive support rule is a condition of our settlement. It does have oversight by the court as we go forward with that. It did come to the legislature in a couple of different ways, but probably not as clear as this to the Child Care Association. So we did in 2012, received rulemaking authority, but it was contingent upon appropriations, which were not granted. 2013, we were directed to adopt rules governing the use of positive supports, and this was specific to license holders under a particular license, 245E. And then in 2014, there was additional action that was taken by the legislature as we had been working with the federal court in gaining compliance on our actions with the Jensen settlement. And that one did lead to legislation which expanded the applicability of the rulemaking to include all DHS licensed programs that serve children with developmental disabilities. And we realized that was a big expansion, and that was one of the things we've been working on. We know that when there's schools involved and others, that is a place that can often provide much of the assistance and intervention that's necessary, and that's another place we're really interested. If there's a child that really is exhibiting the kinds of behaviors that go beyond what a child care provider may be able to do easily, how do we bring in the right support to that? And that would be a means of perhaps mitigating some of the concerns. Who else can come to the table to support that?
Before we proceed, can you clarify, you referenced 245 was a D or E, which is certain licenses. What is included in that section so we know the scope that at that point was at?
So the original 2013 rulemaking scope. It's the chapter is 245D. This is specific for services primarily for people with disabilities. So we have home and community-based waivers. We have different types of facilities. And so there's a scope of services that are required to be licensed there, and that is typically for people with disabilities to assure that they are receiving appropriate services.
Now, a little bit more clarification, the entities that were affected by that, did that include the daycare centers and providers in that chapter?
So, Mr. Chair, it did not include, are you talking about child care providers?
Well, that's why we're trying to get clarification.
Right, because daycare centers mean something broader. So I was in my mind, and we can have Reggie here, but it did not include child care providers.
Okay, so the point at which the department decided to expand it to include daycare, child care providers, what exact point was that, and were you also aware of the legislation and law that required if it was above a certain percent and small employers that it would need legislative approval before the rules could take effect?
Mr. Chair, this came back before the legislature in 2014 to expand the rulemaking authority based on the negotiations that were occurring between the department and the federal court. So this was not an administrative decision. This was something that had been discussed. It did come back in 2014. During the rulemaking process, that was one of the considerations about the cost. Last year, there was a bill to ask the legislature to require all providers to comply with the rule, and that was not acted on, and the governor did sign an order that this would apply to all providers.
So if I'm understanding correctly, instead the normal process is required by law of the legislature approving these rules was bypassed by, was an executive order, a letter,
to
what degree was the activity by the administration?
I may have to ask somebody else to come down to be very exact about the precise nature of that waiver that was done.
And, if staff could clarify if that's ever been upheld by law that the executive branch can, bypass the legislative branch when it's specified in statute. It seems to me as being a little overreach beyond, the separation of powers.
Mr. Chair, members, I just want to clarify, it's section 245.8251, there's a typo, I left off the one in the bill summary, that incorporates the 2014 change that the testifier was talking about to include all licensed facilities and licensed services, authorizing the rulemaking. As far as the governor's actions and any sort of executive overreach, I would have to look into that further to see if that's been addressed.
Well, thank you. And I'm sure several members of our committee would like to understand the process, since it's different than what the legislature is used to. And I see a new face before us. If you could state your name and affiliation, please.
My name is Karen Sullivan Hook. I'm Deputy Senior Counsel at the Department of Human Services. Good morning.
And please go on to clarify for us.
Certainly, Chair. I think I can clarify some of what the Chair has been asking about. So Minnesota Statute 14127 is, I believe, what the Chair is referring to when you're talking about this threshold question about the cost of implementing a rule in the first year that a rule is in effect. That actually applies to small businesses and or small cities. So it's a small business if they have fewer than 50 full-time employees, small city if they have fewer than 10 full-time employees. And what that statute says is that if a rule will cost one of those small businesses or small cities more than $25,000 in the first year of implementation of a rule, then it's supposed to come to the legislature for approval. I would just point out here that the city child care centers that are represented by MCCA do not qualify as, generally, do not qualify as small businesses. So that would not be affected by that statute. But that statute goes on further to say that there are certain exceptions, and one of those exceptions is that the governor can issue a waiver of application of that statute. So that's what happened in this case.
Thank you. And Representative Kreischer, you appear to have a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, and I'm sorry, I didn't catch the testifier's name.
Karen Sullivan Hook.
Sullivan
Hook? Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Sullivan Hook. So, okay, so let's not sugarcoat what you just said there. In the first year of a rule, if it costs small cities, and I'll just use them, $25,000 or more, according to this waiver, they can ask for an exemption from that. And so I'm reading right off of the waiver that was issued by Governor Dayton, and it says, the administrative law judge's disapproval of the agency's cost determination triggers the application of that statute. Two more paragraphs down, and this is the exact quote, the state of Minnesota recognizes that the claim of temporary exemptions would undermine the purpose of this rule. So basically what they did was they disregarded that process and threw it to the curb and said, we think our decision-making is more important than going back to the legislature, and we think that it will undermine the purpose of what we're trying to do, so therefore ignore and go forth or issue a waiver.
Ms. Sullivan.
Is that how I read that?
Representative Kreischer, Chair, I'm not going to speak for the governor's office, but I would point out that a bill was brought before the legislature last year in order to give the legislature an opportunity to address the question, and it was not taken up.
Before Representative Kreischer starts, I would let the people that were listening at home or in the audience, a lot of bills are brought before. I mean, I bring bills just to bring up the topic, and they never reach a committee, let alone the floor, and it's important that it was a bill, but it doesn't have the force of law unless it's passed by both bodies, given to the governor, and the governor signs it. And so that distinction is not trivial. Representative Kreischer, did you have a...
Yeah, I'd like to continue my line.
Representative Kreischer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, okay, I understand you don't want to speak for the governor, but I'll speak to the process. What this appears to me is, and to your point, Ms. Sullivan Hook, you came to the legislature, you came to one of the parents, and the parent said no. So you went to the other parent to get permission.
Ms. Sullivan.
My kids do it to me all the time.
I would just again point out that according to 214.127, there are exceptions available under the law, and that's the process that was followed.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kreischer.
And I would just point out that we have a huge expansion that way is beyond the purview of where this started. And it seems to me that DHS, who made the call? Who ordered this? I mean, who decided to go to the governor and say, hey, we need to expand this way beyond where it started?
Ms. Sullivan.
Representative Kreischer, I think you're asking about the expansion of the application of the applicability of the rule, the scope of the rule. Is that your question?
Representative Kreischer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, let me just walk this through, and I'm just trying to understand this. So we had a court case. Some determinations were made. I don't know, you know, who was in the room or how. There was a court case that decided to expand this on, and at some point a conversation must have been had that said, let's expand it beyond the scope of this, from the adult lawsuit all the way down to these. Is that a normal process, and who made that determination to go to that expansion?
Ms. Sullivan.
Thank you, Chair. So a lot of that happened before my tenure at DHS, so I'm not going to be able to answer some of those questions about what happened in the room. But what I can say is that in the course of settling the lawsuit, there was extensive negotiations and a global settlement agreement was made, and through the implementation of that agreement is when the decision was made to take what used to be referred to as Rule 40, which applied to aversive and deprivation procedures used with people with disabilities or developmental disabilities, to, quote, modernize that rule. And the positive supports rule is the result of that effort. So the positive supports rule replaces the old Rule 40 and a decision was made to have that apply to all DHS licensees.
Final, Representative Prisho.
Final line on this question. So, and I'm not calling into question anything you've done. I mean, I actually understand why we got here, and I can understand some of the well-intentioned thinking. However, I do want to focus on the process because we do have a process down here. Let me walk this through a timeline that I've started to put in my head, and I want to see if it's plausible, and anybody can answer this. So the court case happened. Somewhere along the line, there was a determination that perhaps we should expand this down. And the reason I can say that that conversation must have happened because you came back, someone came back to the legislature to ask for permission, and it was weighed out, it was discussed, and decided that probably is not a good place to go with this. So the, as you said, it didn't pass, which in our terms means we didn't support the idea, didn't think it was the right thing to do or whatever that committee was. Then it came back to DHS who said, well, we can get a waiver from the governor, which I have right here. And so it was essentially going around the decision-making process. And it's certainly within the governor's purview to do that, but I think the second-term effects of what I'm hearing today is we've gotten to a point now where this is created uncertainty, it's created a lot of consternation with our daycare providers, and the rulemaking process has once again shown that perhaps that's a bit more expansive than the legislative process allows for, which frankly upsets legislators when they have to go back to their district and say this wasn't ever our intent, and now I'm suddenly have to dealing with rules that are being made without our weighing in. Is that a plausible timeline?
Ms. Sullivan.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Prescott, I can't agree with all of what you said. I think there's a little, I don't want to say confusion, but I'm not going
to... Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, I'm really just trying to understand this.
Sure. You know, I
Ms.
think
Sullivan.
It's a complicated process, and I think that it would be helpful to sit down and go through step by step, because I think there's a little bit of confusion between what the 14.127 requires in terms of looking at the costs and who that really applies to. As I mentioned, it's only the small businesses and small cities, not the whole situation. And then also, of course, the coming back to the legislature to expand the rulemaking authority that was done in 2013, I think. 14 is when we came back to the legislature to ask for the rulemaking authority to be expanded, and what the process was leading up to that and the thinking of that and how that was presented to the legislature. So I'm not sure I answered your question.
Representative Prisho.
Thank you. And so my final point on this is I just go back to this was put into place. People knew this was going to cause some disapproval. There was and the waiver specifically said, nope, we think this will undermine what the efforts of the expansion, so we're not going to give that temporary exemption. I think it's pretty clear to me what happened. So,
the author is sitting there quietly during this discourse, some of it energetic, and I wanted to give the author, Chair Franson, an opportunity if she'd wanted to speak at this time, interject into this part of the discussion, or if you want to wait till later, that's fine too.
I'm really enjoying the line of questioning, Mr. Chair. But I am wondering, I thought it was really interesting when the comment about centers are not small business, and where you came up with that idea, as well as do you consider then licensed family home providers not small business either?
Ms. Sullivan.
I'm sorry, Chair. Thank you. The statute clearly lays out what is a small business or a small city, and so if I misspoke, I apologize. I think typically centers often are not small businesses if they have more than 50 full-time employees. Family child care providers typically are small businesses, so they would fall under that potential exemption.
Chair Franson.
But not every center has 50 employees or more.
Correct. I understand.
So they would qualify for the exemption.
Yes.
And at this point, are there any other testifiers from the audience? And again, when you, if you start out with your name and affiliation, that would be great.
My name is Elizabeth Bangard, and I am the owner and director of Here We Grow Early Childhood Center, as well as a consultant for other centers in our area. I'm trying to gather my thoughts because I just absorbed a lot of information. I think we're really missing the heart of the problem here. We have put 20 million Band-Aids on something, and the Band-Aids aren't holding each other together anymore. I've begun to do a lot of research into other state licensing, and I really feel it starts at the top with leadership, and that is something I will continue to state needs to be addressed. QRIS's quality rating system, such as Parent Aware, they are adding a family partnership component this year. And I feel like this is taking away from the relationships we have with families. There's already things that we need to do in Rule 9503.0065 that talks about children with special needs and IEPs. I humbly will say I consider myself to be a fairly educated person. The bachelor's degree and a master's degree, and this rule is extremely challenging. And I become increasingly more frustrated when I hear about exemptions that I'm unaware of or trainings or how we're going to do those trainings. I'm already one person, and I don't know if I can afford to add another person to help me with my paperwork or with rule following or mentoring teachers. And I think this rule is going to be very hard to be implemented when the director requirements are still so low. Within a century, if you're a director and you're 18 years old, not to go back to what I keep repeating, but are you going to then designate a teacher to try and do this, whether or not in the classroom, are you going to hire a separate person? At what point are we going to stop making 40 more pages of rules and look at the leadership and the actual structure, I guess, is maybe my point.
Thank you. No member questions? And any other members from the audience that wish to speak? I want to thank you for your testimony because it's good to get the input for a person that's actually involved and knows the children as a person as opposed to just a abstract in the law. And I see some, if you can state your name and affiliation and your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Reggie Wagner, I oversee the licensing division at the Department of Human Services, and I wanted to just very briefly address some of the comments related to the compliance and the oversight of it. What I would say, and I think the testimony that you have heard today shows, is that the genesis and the rollout of this has not been typical. It did go through a rulemaking process, but unlike many of the rules that are developed and that govern our license holders, generally those rules come from within that community, if you will. It comes from a stakeholder process or a need that's identified that often rests within that one licensed area. And there is generally a very comprehensive and robust process in which many people can come and partake in that. That is not to say that child care providers were not excluded or engaged in this process, but it was a very different type of rule that was being developed. And it was also, as you heard some testimony, being developed as part of a federal lawsuit that was being resolved. That has added to some of the complexities of both sort of rolling it out, and then I think some of the confusion has also been with the department wanting to move very slowly in how we would enforce the rule. Licensing does not want to ever be in a gotcha situation where we just say, okay, the rule became effective August 31st, September 1, we're going to start. We have spent time trying to talk with ourselves within the department to understand how this rule applies differently across all of our license settings, across chemical dependency treatment centers, detox programs. They all serve different populations. They're all subject to this rule. We have done some outreach with some membership trade groups and stakeholder groups to engage in a conversation to get some feedback on it. As Ms. Sanford, when she testified earlier, acknowledged, we have been preparing some FAQs, frequently asked questions, specific to each of the licensed areas so that we could try to help translate, if you will, the positive support rule into what is already required for various licensing groups. And there are, in fact, provisions in rule and statute that broadly cover these same topics as the positive support rule for both child care centers and family providers. And I think some of the testifiers, our last one, spoke to that. We, in terms of compliance, we intend to continue to educate about what the rule requires to help people understand how much is perhaps more sane than different, to continue to work with stakeholders and with our own understanding of where training requirements, there are some that are required, and then there are electives that providers can choose and their staff can choose to sort of round out their training requirement. And so that can make it challenging to figure out what is out there in the menu of training and how might, if somebody chooses that, how might that already meet the existing training requirements here. Working with the with the Center for Inclusive Child Care, we hope that they will, both for family providers and centers, help us to kind of make that a little bit more structured, and then to see where there's opportunities to expand some of the content so that if somebody was already going to pick a particular training, could we expand some of that content to make certain that it would cover some of these categories and so not have it look like there's just a complete add-on of new courses. When we begin rolling out a new rule within licensing, we generally try to give a period in which we are providing information and technical assistance about what the expectations are. And at any point when we are looking at enforcing it, we are sort of weighing the factors. And so I think what I want to do is to say that in general, we would be looking at a case-by-case basis. Do they have a child that meets the provisions of the rule? That's the first one. And clearly, for child care centers and family providers, that really is the most challenging part. When you look at our home and community-based waiver 245D licensed providers, everyone that they serve meets the rule. Once you get beyond that license category, it can get more challenging. And so we totally understand the sort of concern. How do I know I'm supposed to be in compliance? How do I know what I need to do before I can serve a child? And I think that we are really committed to moving slowly into this, to providing technical assistance, to citing for a violation if we feel we really need to, but we'd also be looking at, had we been out and talked with them before? You know, how long had the child been there? Had they really been asking all of those questions and being in dialogue with the parent and showing some awareness that they need to do more? What had they already been doing in compliance with their behavior guidance plans that they're all required to have under existing statute, which we think really put providers in a great deal of compliance with the spirit. The real thing I think people have talked about is that kind of more strict training requirement in hours that the positive support rule includes. And so we want to be very clear that many of the protections that the positive support rule addresses are currently addressed within existing rules and the policies and plans, but the rule does go further. It does have some very specific training requirements, and that's the piece that we're trying to both identify resources and also begin, with the rule being 18 months past its effective date, to make certain that we are looking as we go out on reviews and providing technical assistance. So I realize that may not be as clear for providers. We know that with any rule or statute that's out there, a provider always wants to be in compliance. They want to know, what can I do to make sure that when you come to visit me, I'm going to, you know, show you my best, and I don't want to have to feel like I don't understand what that is. We've been trying to develop the information. I'm happy to accept some criticism for the county family child care providers. I think you've heard enough testimony from me and others that that can be very challenging to kind of educate the child care licensors first, as well as the providers. And so we have sort of proceeded even a little bit more slowly. We've been looking at things this spring that were going to be more structured in getting to providers. So I just wanted to perhaps address a few comments that I've heard related to the compliance and to speak on behalf of what licensing might do, since the authority to enforce this ultimately rests with us.
Thank you. And before we go on, we've got some people with questions. A lot of the providers that were, you know, mainly impacted by this area aren't here. Several have provided written testimony, which should be in your packets, and that would I find very useful. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, getting around, I guess, the conversation that we've been hearing today and hearing from some of the providers, I guess I just have concerns that it seems like some of this rulemaking has been sort of a reaction to sort of one bad apple, and then it seems that 8 to 4 hours of training to address an issue that maybe wasn't a big issue and is now very onerous for these small business owners. Are there any training variances available to providers? And then remember that we also ran into training availability, especially in Greater Minnesota. I don't know, Ms. Wagner, if you can answer any of those types of concerns.
Ms. Wagner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, the Commissioner does have the authority to grant variances. We would consider those on a case-by-case basis. We would also be factoring in the availability of specific training if we were ever in a position where we were trying to look at, would we cite somebody for a violation. If the training is not available, we would certainly be factoring in their ability to comply with it. So we do not have any variances developed. That isn't a route that we are going. We would expect that people are coming into compliance with the rule, but just like with some, you know, staff qualifications at times, we can get some time-limited variances.
Representative Peterson.
That was, I guess, my question. So basically there have been no variances offered at this point.
Ms. Wagner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, generally the variance is a request to the department to vary a specific rule for a particular provider with the reasons spelled out. It is not generally something that the department just sort of initiates and puts together, generally.
Follow up?
I understand that you wouldn't give variances all the time, because otherwise what's the point of the rule? But I guess I'm hearing that, no, you haven't given any variances that you're aware of.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yes, that is correct.
Representative Kusha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Wagner. And first of all, I hope you don't feel like you're being criticized. I mean, I understand where you're at, and I'll parse some of my words as well. I mean, we have a delicate dance down here. You have a role, we have a role, but at the end of the day, we represent people, and that's who we're accountable to. And so, I guess what I would put in front of us going forward is, you know, clearly there was some decisions made to expand this, and probably had some very good thought behind it. The intentions are there. I absolutely get that. I think that where we could improve on this is an opportunity now. From what I've heard, I mean, there wasn't egregious abuses out there. There wasn't this climate where, oh my gosh, we've got to deal with this right now. So instead, perhaps we can both play our roles. The administration and the executive branch can talk to us, and we can come up with some ideas together. I heard from Ms. Sanford, that the conversations have been good with DHS. But let's include both parents here. Let's include Representative Franson, who's been one of our biggest advocates for child care providers. And, you know, we've all worked through bills. We all work with the executive branch. Sit down and have those conversations and come to agreement and come shoulder to shoulder. versus nose to nose. And I think that's where we're right now. We don't need to be there. There is no urgency to get this out the door today from what I'm hearing. So let's take time, let's let it work through the process, and let's do it right, rather than get in a position where we have to point fingers when we go back to the people we represent, because they're just going to be mad at all of us.
And I would add, Representative Kreisha, the only urgency is that the governor chose to do a procedure so that the legislation didn't get mature and passed before the expectation was put upon the daycare providers. Ms. Wagner? No, that's fine. Are there any other members of the public that wish to testify? Oh, Representative Flanagan, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One is just a statement. I wonder how Part C might be a better fit as we're talking about serving children, young children especially, with disabilities. So I just want to put that out there and see maybe that's an additional conversation that we can have. The other question that I had is for Representative Franzen, if there's been conversations with folks in the disability community about this bill in particular and sort of the spirit of it.
No, there's been no conversation.
Thank you.
And again, any other questions or members of the public that wish to testify? Seeing none, would the author, representative, and Chair Branson have some statements?
I just want to remind the body that we are bleeding child care providers in the state of Minnesota, and without providers, we are not going to have a robust workforce. The burden of the cost to the business from this training is going to be passed on to those families who are already burdened, with some of them, with costs that they cannot afford currently. And this will be shouldered on all parents of all income levels. We also have county licensors currently who will write up providers when an infant falls asleep while on a walk, or if the provider is holding a baby too long. I can only imagine the mess that this is going to create from county to county on licensors interpreting how this rule should affect licensors in this, in their county. But we want children of all abilities to be in the least restrictive community settings possible. And typical child care providers are one of the places that young children with special needs can thrive in inclusive environments. I thank you for your time this morning and look forward to having another robust discussion in the next committee.
Thank you, Representative Franzen. And do you wish to, well, first of all, is there any other? Seeing no further discussion. Would you like to renew your motion?
I'd like to recommend this bill be moved to, I believe, Health and Human Services Reform. House File Quad X.
Representative Franzen renews her motion. The unnumbered House File Quad X before us be approved and recommended to the Committee on HHS Reform. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. And it passes.
Thank you.
Seeing that we've completed our agenda, we are adjourned.